The Endless Mystery Story of Human Behavior.
For me, I guess what draws me into a story is that whatever that inciting moment is for me reaches very deeply into me in a way that I think, oh, there's so much more here to mine. There's something that really connects to me. It's sinking its claws into me. I don't know what it is. So my job is to sort of, you know, wrestle with it until I find out why that resonates with me.
Vax Fiction writer Marissa Silver. We spend the hour with her today talking about her work and the craft of writing. This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Called one of California's most celebrated contemporary writers by the New York Times, Marissa Silver writes both long and short fiction. We first spoke to her in 2008 about her wonderful novel, God of War. We'll air that interview in the second half of the show. Now she's come out with an equally wonderful collection of stories, Alone with You. One theme they explore is the ambiguities in human relationships, the push and pull we feel towards those we love. And other is the responsibilities we have toward each other. I sat down with Marissa Silver at her publisher, Simon & Schuster, in New York recently to talk about the craft of writing and her latest collection of stories. Marissa Silver, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
The last time I spoke with you, it was about a novel. This Alone With You is a collection of wonderful stories. I really just want to kind of dive into different ones of them, if you don't mind. Let's just start out with Temporary. All of them, I think, had surprises in them. And I think that that was some of the, aside from the language, which is also really beautiful, it's the surprise in every story that really got me. And here in Temporary, tell us a little bit about the main character of this story.
Temporary is a story about a young woman in her early 20s named Vivian, and she's just recently moved to Los Angeles from Oklahoma. Her mother has died recently, and she's sort of just starting out life, and she finds a temporary situation living with another girl named Shelley in a sort of a loft downtown that shouldn't be lived in, and it's really an industrial space. And she's sort of beginning to make her way in her life. She gets a job at an adoption agency, which has a resonance in her own life because she too is adopted. And the story is really, you know, really about just that temporality of life, that, you know, her growing recognition of how fleeting things are, how hard it is to locate yourself in your life. It's a lot about being that age, you know, that time in your 20s where you sort of walk through any door that's open and you're not quite sure why, and then suddenly you find yourself someplace or with some people and you're not even sure why. That it's not so much about being choiceful as it is about just sort of taking whatever road seems to appear. And that's how you begin to define who you are. She's sort of an undefined character. She's sort of someone who's grappling for who she is. And so the story really is about that moment in life.
Yet she does need to make a choice in this, a choice of what to believe about her own parents' marriage. So there's another plot going on here. Her mother is ill. Her father is a loving father. And yet there's a question.
Yeah, she sees him in a moment with another woman, and she can't quite understand what that moment means. She's not sure how to interpret it. She has to make a decision about what to believe, and a lot of what the story is about is sort of how you have to make decisions what you're going to believe, and they could be wrong or they could be right. It ultimately doesn't matter. It's more about the decision that you make, and I think that we all do that in life as we go along about, you know, who to trust, about loyalty, about, you know, intimacy. And, you know, you make these choices, and there's never a lot of evidence, and yet you make choices. So that's something that she experiences.
It doesn't matter what choice you make?
Well, I think it matters what choice you make, but I don't know that you know what the right choice is, really. I mean, a choice may appear right to you. Is it right? I don't know. I mean, we all have moral judgments, and we all can say, oh, well, he shouldn't have left his wife, or you know, but, you know, how do we know? We don't really know. And what life is about the sum of those choices. So I guess when I write, I tend to be less judgmental of my characters and more sort of open to understanding choice and what the ramifications of choices are. I'm not so much interested in moralizing or trying to depict a world that's black and white. I'm much more interested in the ambiguity and the grays.
Yeah, in fact, I wrote down as I was thinking of this interview, I wrote down ambiguities. That is the place that you inhabit in these stories, and I think that that's why they do have the surprises that they do, because one doesn't really know what a character is going to do. In Leap, that's another story in which there's some kind of ambiguity. There's a dog who is seen as attempting suicide.
Leap is a sort of a slightly more humorous story about, but actually at its heart, it's not. It's about a woman who is sort of understanding the connection between danger and love, and how love can be dangerous. She has a dog who she's devoted to, and at one point in the story, the dog sort of takes this unreasonable leap off a cliff. It doesn't seem to be in response to anything like a scurrying squirrel or food. She decides to interpret it as the dog choosing to commit suicide. The dog doesn't die. But I think the fact that she interprets it that way is what's important. It's not whether or not the dog did. And, you know, I don't know whether animals choose to kill themselves. I have no idea. I think it's probably a human construct. And so it's probably hard to, you know, lay that on an animal. But the fact that she thinks that has a lot to do with what she's struggling with in the story, to try to understand, you know, when life is difficult, what makes you hold on?
Yeah, and there's a point in the story in which she feels, well, maybe love is too dangerous. Her marriage is not going well. But then at the end of the story, she's happy that there was so much trouble yet to come. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that what she understands in the story is that part of what makes life rich and surprising is the fact that there's trouble. I mean, you know, that there are complications, that it's not obvious, that it's not easy, that you're sorting through things that are troubling and difficult. And I think that she sort of, you know, she's in a place where she's got to choose whether to remain with a guy who is sort of stepping out on her or not. And I think that she doesn't, and recognizes that, you know, that's part of where her emotional juice is going to come from is the troubles.
It's interesting. We were just talking before we started about some issues facing people of our generation with our parents. I'm facing that. And I was just saying to you that, you know, with all the trouble, it's been an enriching experience. It's made me become a better person.
Yeah. I mean, you know, not always. Sometimes trouble makes you do things that aren't, you're not showing off your best side. But that's life. You know, we are confronted with things and we behave. And sometimes we behave in ways that, you know, sort of amplify the goodness of us. And sometimes we behave in ways that reveal the pettiness of us. And that's what's interesting. I mean, to me, that's what's interesting about character. That's what draws me to write, is because I always think of those advent calendars at Christmas where you open a door. I mean, everybody's a little door that can be opened. And then you see inside and you see how they behave and you see how they react to certain situations and then how they react to the consequences of those certain situations. And it's like a endless mystery story, human behavior.
It almost sounds, the way you're talking, as if it's like Zen, like to be a writer is to be able to observe and to observe with compassion one's own characters. That is to be a fiction writer.
Yeah, although I don't think there's anybody in my life who would describe me as Zen, but I'll take that. I think that for me, yeah, I mean, writing is two things. It's about observing. It's also about shaping. I mean, there's a craft in writing. And so, you know, I am exerting a kind of architecture and a shape on the work that I make. I'm bringing craft to it. So there's definitely it's sort of a combination of those two things. It's both being the observational eye and then shaping that into a narrative that someone would want to read. I mean, we don't always want to hear, you know, the real stories of our lives are not always fascinating or interesting. The real dialogue that we say to one another is not always fascinating or interesting. So part, I think, of what the writer, I think, gets to do is to find the shape of the story and bring their craft to the story so that life is a little bit heightened. And we recognize our lives but we're being shown something that maybe is a little bit sort of floating a little bit above the normal life that we all live.
But doesn't compassion also come into it? And that's certainly the sense that I get from reading these stories in Alone with You, Marissa Silver. I get the sense that there's a real, in being able to explore the ambiguities, you can only do that from a point of compassion for your characters.
I agree with you. I mean, I think that, as I said earlier, you know, to be judgmental, I think, is to not only lose your characters in all their colors, but also to lose a reader because, you know, a reader doesn't want to be told what to think of somebody. They want to decide what they want to think of that character themselves. And the only way that I can write characters in a way that feels where they become palpable and rich to me is to sort of suspend is to be compassionate for their foibles. I mean, not everyone in this book does, you know, a good or right thing in sort of a subjective way. I mean, in an objective way. So yeah, I have tremendous compassion. I don't even sort of even think about it in a funny way. You know, when I'm inhabiting characters, I just think about what are they going to do? I feel for them, but mostly I'm just concerned with what they're doing. I'm not even really thinking about, am I compassionate or not? I'm just saying this feels the thing that they would do.
How does that happen?
It happens in a really slow way. It happens a lot in the way that real relationships happen in life, I think. You know, when you meet somebody, you know very little about them. You have certain cues, what they look like, maybe what they said about something, and you begin to, little by little, knowing them more and more, begin to sort of deepen your understanding of who they are. And, you know, they may behave a certain way in a situation. You think, oh, they're a little different than I thought. You know, your understanding them becomes more nuanced. And with character, it's really the same thing. I mean, I start off with a shred of, I mean, almost nothing, you know, a woman, a girl, somebody with long hair, you know, there might be that much. And then I sort of throw action in their way, and I try to see how they'll behave in the face of those actions, and those that helps me understand them more. And you know, it's I don't know who they are at the beginning. I'm learning in the same way that a reader is going to be learning as he or she reads the story. So it's a long process of digging deeper and deeper and deeper, and trying to find out what the difference is between who they say they are and what they really are and what their actions reveal about themselves that might be different from what they thought. I think everybody carries around a certain mythology about themselves, which is often at odds with the way other people perceive them. And then it's a lot about how they are perceived by others. I mean, you know, we are only perceptions of other people. You know, I mean, we may have our own idea of ourselves, but we are known through other people as well. So, you know, it's always thinking about, well, how does another person see that person? So a character exists on so many different levels, and it's just a long, sort of slow, patient process to get deeper and deeper.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with fiction writer Marissa Silver about her latest collection of stories, Alone With You. I wonder if you could tell us about that process with one of my favorite stories in this book, although that was hard to choose because there were many that I loved. But that one is Pond.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. I love that story. Pond is a story that's told in three sections, and it is a story about – it begins as a story about a family, a mother and a father and a 24-year-old daughter who's developmentally delayed. So she probably behaves much like a 4-year-old. And she's pregnant. And in the first part of the story, you see the family sort of, you know, dealing with this imminent birth of a child. And then the second part of the story takes place a few years later when the mother and the daughter and the baby are at a duck pond. And the third part of the story takes place about 7 years later when the father and the daughter and the now 9-year-old boy are by a river. And it's a story that was really – I mean, I never know what my stories are about when I write them. And I oftentimes don't know what they're about for a long time after I write them. This is when I really didn't know what it was about, and I kept changing points of view. Because I kept thinking, there's more here, and I need to go, you know, see it from a different angle. And so by the end of the story, even I was surprised at what the story became about, which was sort of it ends up being really the father's story, which is the character who you know the least in the beginning of the story. So it was a really exhilarating story to write. You know, it was a story where I was dealing both with the emotion and also with the form of writing, which was really fun.
How did you alight on the character of Martha?
You know, I don't know. I never know how to answer that question. Characters kind of appear. And I mean, I hate to say that because it sounds so, you know, gooey or, you know, I'm too hard bitten for that kind of thing. But characters do appear. And I mean, they appear, I suppose, as a result of a lot of subconscious thought, a lot of rumination, but not pointedly so. You know, I never start a story by saying, oh, I'm going to write about a girl and her father. And I don't. I sort of suddenly this character appeared and I had the first line of the story. And then I just started going with that. I suddenly had a situation. Here's a woman who's developmentally delayed and is pregnant. What now? Mm-hmm. Sometimes stories start with an image. Sometimes stories start with a line of dialogue. It's really random. And I think that there's, but for me, I guess what draws me into a story is that whatever that inciting moment is for me reaches very deeply into me in a way that I think, oh, there's so much more here to mine. There's something that really connects to me. It's sinking its claws into me. I don't know what it is. So my job is to sort of, you know, wrestle with it until I find out why that resonates with me. Because there's plenty of ideas that I have that, you know, seem superficially interesting and they don't go deep. Then I can't get to the next place with them. They don't really sink their claws into me. They don't have the emotional resonance for me that I need to spend time with something.
In this character, in the relationship between this character, Martha, who's developmentally delayed, and her son, I felt a kind of echo of your first, the book that I spoke to you about last time, The God of War. There also, there's a character who's taking care of his mentally, autistic mm-hmm. brother.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think the issues of responsibility, the responsibilities that we have towards one another is something that I still think about and write about. It interests me, you know, the family structure interests me. I think because it's this kind of potent, constantly changing structure. People are growing, people are splitting up, coming together. There's never a stasis in a family structure. And, so one of the things that really interests me about family is how we draw the lines between ourselves and our responsibility to the other people who are close to us. And I think it's an always changing line. I don't think that it's ever stable. In another story in the collection called Night Train to Frankfurt, it's about a woman who's taking her mother to this esoteric clinic in Frankfurt, Germany, as a last ditch effort to cure her mother of a really, you know, a virulent cancer. And so it's sort of a fool's journey from the start. I don't think, you know, I'm not sure anybody in the story believes what it's going to do any good, but they're doing it. There's sort of this hope. And it's a lot about this woman who's in her, I guess she's in her early 30s, sort of trying to figure out where she stands vis-a-vis her mother, where her responsibility to her mother is, where her responsibility to following her mother's kind of offbeat strategies for dealing with her cancer lie. And I guess that those really interest me. I think that, I mean, the collection as a whole, I mean, the title Alone With You is sort of, you know, the stories all circle around this idea of, you know, how are we together and alone at the same time? And how does intimacy and separation, how do they coexist? Because I think they do. And I don't think that you're always intimate with somebody. I think you have these transcendent moments of intimacy, but there's always this sense of the aloneness of the individual, which is sort of intractable. And so all these stories wrestle in some way with this idea of, you know, when are we close and when are we not? You know, how are we, if we're all these, you know, planets that are orbiting each other, when do we draw close and when do we pull away?
And there's a point in that story, Night Train to Frankfurt, where that character, the daughter, enters that kind of a certain moment of grace where it's enough just to simply be. Mm-hmm. And she accepts that things are not in life the way you expect them to be.
Yeah, she has there's a sort of another storyline in that story. The daughter, one of her jobs is she's a page turner for the Philharmonic. And so she recounts a story of being present when the pianist sort of fumbles and stumbles. And the moment where she doesn't know what her responsibility is in that moment and what it is best for her to do. You know, you don't stand up and point to the page in the middle of the Philharmonic. On the other hand, she feels that she's somehow suddenly tied in this incredible drama with this woman. And it's very much the same thing that exists for her with her mother. You know, how does she can't. I think what she realizes is that she can't help her mother live, but she can be present as she gets through the rest of her life.
Then the title story, Alone With You, there the perspective shifts. You have a woman who has been diagnosed or suffering with some kind of mental illness. Her family is, you know, feeling an exaggerated kind of sense of responsibility toward her. Not exaggerated in the sense that it's wrong, but in the sense that they're not altogether comfortable about, you know, what they have to do mm-hmm. for her. And she takes them on a journey into the desert in which she's looking for some kind of freedom.
Yeah. I in that story, the woman sort of suffers. So, you know, she's from a very deep kind of anxiety and depression. And I think that, I mean, the twist in that story is as you said, that it's, you know, the family who feels that they're taking care of her. And in a way, what happens by the end of the story is that she's made a choice of how to take care of them, which may be something very different from what they felt should be done. But for her, it's the only choice to make.
In fact, I wondered if you'd be willing to read a little piece from that story, which I just thought was wonderful. In fact, it's the very end. Set us up first, but I'd like you to start right here.
And go to the end? They're in the desert in Morocco, and along this journey, the son's girlfriend has gotten ill, and the mother has stayed with the girlfriend while the others went ahead. And now they've all convened at the camp, and it's nighttime. The father is Edward, I should say, and Teddy is the son, and Elise is the son's girlfriend, and Maria is the main character. Edward stood back, his expression contorting slightly as he watched the young couple discover the sky. Marie remembered when Edward had shown Teddy how to cast a rod, his pride in his own mentoring replaced by the recognition of loss, as Teddy easily grasped the technique. Marie understood that for her husband, knowledge was his defense against emptiness. How hard it had been for him this year to have understood so little of what she was experiencing. She had betrayed him. She hadn't meant to, but that's what had happened. Marie chose not to sleep that night. When she'd begun to take the dulling medications, she'd taught herself how to defy sleep. The skill had felt like some measure of victory over her situation. She had loved the nighttime hours, especially when she was not assaulted by the raucous sounds of the day, the car doors opening and slamming shut, the Doppler of the neighborhood children's voices as they walked to and from school. Unmistakable rustlings came from Teddy and Elise's tent, and then stifled moans. Edward, turning in his sleeping bag, and opened his eyes for a moment. His face was soft, his expression confused. "Shh," she whispered, until his eyelids lowered and his breathing became light again. Carefully, she took his hand in hers. She felt its weight, the warmth of it, despite the cold air. She thought of him foolishly chasing after the girl. And why not? Weren't they all turning toward the sun, yearning for life? It was only that they had discovered that they needed to look away from one another to find their futures. She had come to the desert in order to make a decision. She had once been unable to imagine living, but now she could only imagine it. Life was a needy child that you wished both to hold and escape from. She could envision herself inside the tumult, the confusion, the utter illogic of it. She believed she could endure the terror, but she could only manage it alone. But she could not pretend to be other than who she was. She thought about how it would happen. Would she pack her things and drive away while Edward was at work? Or would she stay and confront him with her choice when he returned at the end of the day? A conversation might be difficult for him. It would demand words he did not have, feelings he could not name. She did not want to be unkind. She closed her eyes and saw the stars against the infinite night of her eyelids. She imagined their migration to some other part of the world. Soon, in a place far away, other people would look up and point and wonder and realize that they were only strangers visiting a foreign land.
The foreign land.
You know, it's the world we're in. It's a strange, kind of magical, hard place. And I think that none of us knows what we're in for. And that's both frightening and exciting. I think we don't know the rules. We don't know the customs when we get here, much the way you don't when you're traveling. And we're visitors for a pretty short time. So that's what that line means.
And yet we can see the stars.
We can see the stars. It's incredible. I have been to the desert in Morocco, and I've never seen that. I've never seen a firmament. I understood what the word firmament meant for the first time. It was astonishing. You really felt the vastness of the universe, and you could see the curve of the earth. You could see how the stars were passing across the sky. It was kind of a really exhilarating moment for me.
Marissa Silver, your stunning collection of stories is Alone With You. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marissa Silver. You can read her story, Temporary, at writersvoice.net. Stay tuned for our 2008 interview with Silver about God of War next. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Marissa Silver's haunting work of fiction, The God of War, is a powerful coming-of-age novel about a boy named Ares who confronts a dilemma. How can he learn to balance his responsibility to his autistic younger brother with his own emerging sense of self? Set in the arid landscape of the Salton Sea of California in the mid-1970s, God of War explores the family dynamics that unfold between Ares and his mother, Lauren, a single parent who leans on her older son while distracted by worries of her own. Ares carries a burden of guilt for his brother's condition that Laura knows nothing about. As a result, she leaves him to negotiate the treacherous shoals of adolescence mostly by himself as he learns to become the hero of his own story.
It takes place in 1978, sort of in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, and it takes place in the desert in California in an area called the Salton Sea, which is a very fascinating sort of geographical part of the country and a very bleak and devastated area in a certain way. And Ares lives with his mother, Laurel, and his younger brother, Malcolm, who is six. And they live in a trailer in a town called Bombay Beach by the shores of the Salton Sea. And Ares is sort of at that point where every kid of a certain, you know, pre-adolescent age gets to, where they begin to, you know, sort of stretch their wings and begin to want to break away from the reliance on their parents and the, you know, they're adolescent, pre-adolescent. And Ares' situation is made particularly profound by his situation because he is largely responsible for his brother, who is mentally impaired and doesn't speak. And Laurel, who works as a masseuse, has put a lot of responsibility on Ares for taking care of his brother at school and for getting him to and from places and snacks after school and all the rest of it. He's sort of a latchkey kid. So Ares' need to break away from his family is encumbered by this incredible sense of responsibility that he has towards his brother. And so the battle that he has to fight is how to break away from the sense of responsibility while still, you know, loving and caring for his brother.
And it's even more complicated by the fact that he thinks he's guilty of a terrible crime.
Yeah, when he was younger and his brother was just an infant, he was holding his brother at a gas station and dropped him. And Malcolm fell on his head, and so Ares lives with the sense that he's responsible for the way that his brother is.
Now, his brother, it seems from, is never quite named, but it certainly seems from the symptoms that he's got autism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that he does have autism. I think that in 1978, the words for all these things that we're much more familiar now were not as well known, and certainly in the place where this family lived, which is really kind of a backwater, information about that was not readily available. And so, you know, the reason why I didn't name it was because it really wasn't named in his environment. And the school system that he is in doesn't really identify it as such, and his mother is resistant to identifying it because she doesn't want to kind of put, as she says, put her younger child in a box. She doesn't want him labeled. She's a very kind of anti-government, and she's a little bit of a throw forward from the hippie days, and she's very mistrustful of governments and the kinds of strictures that societies try to put people in. So she doesn't want him to be tested. So in Aries' mind, and the book is very much from the point of view of Aries, he doesn't know what's wrong with his brother, which is why his sense of his own agency and his brother's problem persists for him.
Now, why did you choose these characters? Were they cut out of whole cloth, or is there something in this theme in autism or in parentified children that resonated in particular with you or someone or something you've known in your life?
Well, the characters are completely imagined. They're not based on people that I know. But these characters sort of appeared to me. I think what came to me first in writing this book was the location. I had visited the Salton Sea, and it's really quite an astonishing part of the landscape. You're driving through the desert east of Los Angeles, about 3 hours east, and it's very, bleak and kind of monotonous. And then suddenly you turn a corner, and there in the middle of the desert is this ocean, and it's astonishing that it exists, and the history of it is quite remarkable because it exists. It's a man-made lake. It was created in the early part of the last century when people tried to make the desert arable and farmable, and so they tried to reroute the Colorado River waters, and in doing so created enormous floods that ran down to this very low-lying place and created the Salton Sea. It's the saltiest place on the continent. It's even saltier, I think, than the Great Salt Lake or the ocean. And the sort of ecological situation of it really fascinated me, and then the landscape around it and the people who live around there really compelled me. So I think that's what drew me to the story first, and then these people sort of walked into my imagination, and I created their life there.
And is there something about the theme itself that is of two brothers, one who is so impaired, with a mom who's a massage therapist, that resonate in particularly with this place?
No, I mean, I think it's a story that really could take place any place. I mean, it's not particular to this place, but I think that the way in which these three characters interact with this remarkable landscape was a really a wonderful part of the writing process for me. They all have very different relationships to this incredibly bleak but beautiful desert. Laurel loves it and sort of finds its, what other people would overlook as detritus or things that are not particularly beautiful. She finds very beautiful sort of, sun-bleached stones and little desert plants that thrive despite all deprivation. And Malcolm, who doesn't speak and doesn't really have relationships with most humans, has an intense relationship with the bird life that comes to the water. And Aries, of course, has very ambivalent feelings about living there because he has ambivalent feelings about being sort of stuck in this life where he foresees that he will be the caretaker of his brother for the rest of his life. So I think that the landscape really spoke to each character in a very individual way, and that was a really wonderful thing for me to explore as a writer.
Yeah, and talking now more about Aries, in the first pages of the book, you foreshadow the end of the novel.
And mm-hmm.
Without giving too much away, the narrator, who is now an adult, that's Aries, he's looking back, says he was treated as a hero, but he wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I actually tell the story of the book in the very first page of the book. And I did that very deliberately, obviously, because I didn't feel like the drama, the particular drama that the book hinges on, was really ultimately the story of the book. So I sort of wanted to set it out there to say this happens. It's a very dramatic thing that happens, but it's not actually the central drama of the story. So it was a way to say to the reader, look more closely, look more subtly at the story of this boy growing up. It's not simply a whodunit and howdunit. It's a you know, why done it. So that was a really a very conscious strategy. You know, and it's a story told in retrospect. It's a story told from a man's point of view, looking back at this, you know, very profound and dramatic moment of his life, trying to understand what he has come to as an adult and why he has come to this place.
And yet it really does seem as if you capture the voice of a 12-year-old.
Yeah, that was one of the hardest things to do. I mean, I think we've all read literature from the point of view of children, and usually when we read literature from the point of view of children, we're reading literature from the point of view of incredibly precocious children, because, you know, most of us, if not all of us, are aware of how children speak and think, and they're not always quite as articulate as they may seem in books. And I didn't want to write about a, you know, particularly precocious child. I didn't want to write about some, you know, a one in a million kid. I wanted to write a child who would be more representative of a lot of kids. And so I chose to write from the perspective of the adult because it allowed me to use language and some observations that an adult might have that a child might not have at that moment. So it was a kind of curious blend of both. And it's the voice of an adult looking back. And sometimes when you look back at a moment in your life that was very profound, you're almost right there. And when you're narrating what happens, even though you may be using language that's a little more sophisticated than you might have used as a child, emotionally, you're at that same place that you were as a child. So that's what I was going for. I felt it was going to be a richer voice if I was able to use the blend of the adult and the child voice.
So talk a little bit about the theme of war here. This is entitled The God of War.
Mm-hmm.
That is, of course, Ares is the god of war. Why that theme?
For a lot of reasons. I mean, I think mostly because I felt like that moment in his life where he was trying so desperately to break free of the responsibilities of his family and yet struggling with this sense of incredible love and responsibility for his brother, it was like a battle for him. I mean, it was like an emotional battle. And I feel like it is a battleground for every kid who has to go through it to try to, you know, these parents, mother and father who you once thought were all powerful and all knowing, and then you begin to see the cracks in their behavior and you begin to see the wider world and your own perceptions of that wider world allow you to begin to question the choices that your parents make. And I think it's a really scary and profound moment, and I think it is kind of like an internal battle for identity and for selfhood. So that was the most kind of central sense of war. But then because the book takes place not only in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, which, you know, for all of us who were there, it was kind of a strange, somewhat desultory time of kind of coming to grips with what had just happened, and because one of the characters in the book, Laurel's boyfriend, is a recent Vietnam War vet, that comes into play. And also, I guess another wonderful thing about the location of the Salton Sea was at that time there were marine bombing dropping places right nearby where they would practice war games, and so Ares' world is sort of intermittently interrupted by the sound of distant bombs falling as airplanes practice maneuvers in the desert. And he's very much fascinated by that, as any, you know, boy would be. So there's a lot, you know, the war comes into play in very different ways in his life.
And another thing we think of when we think of wars are heroes. You know, that's a word that's attached to wars, to soldiers. Ari says he wasn't the hero in the first few pages of the book, and yet it does seem to me that he is a heroic character.
I think he is a heroic character. He's like a heroic little kid who struggles through an incredibly complicated battle and, in fact, does defend his brother to the end. But I don't think that he was a hero in the sense that others did, in the sense of, you know, taking up arms and defending his life. He wasn't that kind of hero. But he certainly is heroic in his own way.
Well, which is the greater heroism?
Well, to me, obviously, his heroism.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Marissa Silver about her novel, The God of War. Talk more now about his brother Malcolm and Malcolm's potential act of heroism, or was it?
Well, that does give a little bit of the book away, but what happens in the... let me see if I can talk about this without revealing too much, but Ares comes in contact with a difficult and dangerous boy named Kevin, who he begins to look up to. And Kevin's actions are much more violent and much more authoritative than Ares has ever been able to be, and so Ares is really drawn to that. But Kevin is a really disturbed boy, ultimately, and the choices he makes are incredibly dangerous and incredibly deleterious to Ares and Malcolm. And so there ultimately Kevin dies, which is something that we do find out in the first page. So I don't think I'm giving too much away. And the question is, who killed him, Ares or his brother?
Ares' relationship with his mother, or actually his mother herself, Lauren, she's quite a complicated person who really seems to be cloaking denial in the raiment of love and acceptance of her son Malcolm. I mean, you mentioned before that she doesn't want to label him, and I can certainly, as a mother, I can certainly understand that wish on the part of a parent, because labels do put they put a screen in front of a child between the child and the world that most people can't really look through and perceive the child in, but it doesn't really serve Malcolm all that well.
No, and in fact, Laurel was the most complicated character for me to write because she makes a lot of, I guess we could say, not great choices, but she makes them for all the right reasons. I mean, I feel that she, you know, really has incredible love and a fierce kind of love for her children. And the love for her children is very much born out of her sense of values and what she values in the world, as all of our loves, you know, everything that we do with our children is rooted in our particular values. So, you know, she makes these choices to basically not expose Malcolm to judgment because she really believes in something very pure and true about him. And obviously, certainly in retrospect, you know, in 2001, we all know that those are disastrous choices. But certainly in 1978 and in the place where she lived and in combination with her own particular point of view on the world, which is a little bit mistrustful, those choices were not quite as obvious. So she's a tricky character because she does these things which we see as the book goes on are not great for her kids, but she does them out of her fierce sense of love and also her very profound sense that she does not trust what society will make of her family. So it's interesting to write a character like that because you don't want to sit in judgment of them. You don't want to sit in judgment of any of your characters. You want to understand them and understand where they come from and how their actions affect the others around them. And so it was really a challenge and a great challenge to try to understand her and to try to understand the love that she bears for her children and the complicated love that her children bear for her.
Yeah, and in trying to protect Malcolm, she really seems to throw Ares, you know, under the truck in a way. I mean, she depends. She takes Ares quite for granted, and really doesn't seem to be thinking about his welfare all that much.
Well, I think that, I mean, I guess I don't see it quite as drastically as that. I think that she loves Ares. I think Ares, the way that she's raising Ares is to be quite independent. You know, it's a time when perhaps people weren't quite as frightened of the things that parents are frightened of now. So Ares has an enormous amount of physical independence. He rides his bike everywhere. You know, because of the necessities of her life, she needs him to be home when, you know, school's out and take care of the brother. And, you know, those are sorts of things that come out of the economic necessities of her life. But I wouldn't say that she throws him under the truck. I think that she has a great love for him. But I think that she also, you know, there are certain needs that she has, and he's able to help her. You know, I think that one of the things that interested me when I wrote the book was I think that not only, you know, is it a story of a family that has a child that's impaired, but I think it's a story of a sibling of an impaired child. And I think that that's a really complicated situation to be in when you're the quote-unquote well child in a family where there's a child who's for one or another reason not well. I think it's hard. I think that you feel an incredible sense of responsibility. I think you feel guilt. I think you feel maybe angry. And I think parents are going to sometimes be able to give you the attention you need and sometimes rely on the fact that you don't need so much attention because the other child needs more. So I think that's a particularly profound problem in those kinds of families, and that was something that I was trying to explore.
Yes, when Ares, as an adult, talks about when he looks at photographs of people who have autism or of, you know, children with mental illness, he's always looking for the kids in the background.
Right. He's sort of trying to identify with the brothers and sisters and how they related. And I think that, you know, there's many ways in which those kids can be affected by that in some incredibly powerful ways. I think the level of empathy is huge in children of, you know, siblings of kids who have those kinds of illnesses. But there's also, you know, I think there's many times when the responsibility is loaded on them that wouldn't be loaded on the normal 12-year-old.
Ari says at one point that he says something that he had realized at an earlier point in the book was true for his brother, Malcolm. He says, nothing makes you safe.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say more about what does he mean by that?
Well, I think it really comes from his perspective. I think he doesn't feel safe. I think feeling safe is one of those sort of silver bullets of childhood that you need in order to get through and to be healthy. And I think that I think that his mother's point of view on the world has not made him feel that it's a welcoming and safe place to be. And I think that the environment that he lives in does not make him feel that ultimately he is safe. And I'm not just talking about physical safety. I'm talking about sort of emotional safety. And I think that Aries has a very profound sense that there's a sort of, you know, tenuous quality to his safety. And, you know, he when he's home alone at night, he locks the doors 3-4 times. You know, he never quite feels that, you know, the boogeyman isn't going to come, because sometimes the boogeyman comes from right within the house.
You know, sometimes as I was reading this, I was expecting maybe more of an out-of-the-ordinary tragedy to result. You know, from what you, the foreshadowing that you did in the beginning, I was expecting worse. And when worse didn't happen, I found that this was more powerful, more affecting. It almost seems as if what you're really talking about is the tragedy that really reaches into most ordinary lives at one time or another.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't want to make it sort of a one-off, you know, that this is a story that couldn't happen to you or couldn't happen to somebody next door. To me, the story of family responsibility and of the choices that we make in terms of that responsibility is every single person's story. I mean, whether it's with children or with older parents who are ailing or with, you know, with siblings who are not doing so well in their life. I mean, we all have these moments where we're sort of drawing the line between ourselves and our sense of what we want for ourselves and our sense of a larger familial community and what we have to not do for ourselves so that we can do for our family. And I think those are constant choices that everyone faces, and Aries is facing it too. So I didn't want the drama to be this sort of, you know, big explosive drama. It's really, and I also didn't want it to seem like some, you know, it's a story of a child. It has to be a child-sized drama. It has to have something that you know, is contained in the world of a child. I mean, it's kind of, it's very, you know, it is dramatic and it's violent, and hopefully it doesn't happen in most children's lives, but it seems sort of organic to the world that he was in and to the people that he was dealing with. But, you know, in terms of what the story is really about, it's really about something much more universal, which is this sense of, you know, where do we stand in relation to the people who we love and who we are responsible for, and how do we become ourselves and our individual selves in relationship to those responsibilities.
We're talking with Marissa Silver about her novel, The God of War. You know, I'd like to ask you, go back to a little bit to something you said about Lauren, because I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the writing. You said that you had the most difficulty with writing Lauren's character. How did you wrestle with that difficulty? How did you find your way out of it?
Well, I think it's more about finding your way into it. I mean, I think that when you end up with a complex problem, it's sort of digging deeper and deeper and revealing complexity more than sort of trying to patch it up and walk away and, you know, wipe your hands, for me at least. I think that with any character, it's the same. It's almost like the way you get to know people. You know, you meet a person and you have a sort of initial beat on them, whether it has to do with something they said or their smile or the way they dressed, and you make these determinations about who they are. But then as you get to know them and you get to see how they behave in certain situations and you get to see what their actions are, then you really begin to know them more in a more complex way and appreciate them more, even if you wouldn't necessarily be their friend or necessarily do what they do, but you kind of get who they are based on who they are. And so with Laurel, it was the same thing. It was sort of trying out different behaviors and different actions and trying to feel what was the right thing, who, you know, what makes her fully a person, what makes her actions come from a very true place and not from something that was just sort of expedient for the drama of the novel. So it's about, you know, fleshing a person out and finding things that don't make sense in them, but then, you know, presenting them in such a way that you understand that, not, you know, we all don't make sense. Our actions don't always have to do with what we say. you know, our idea of ourselves is very often different from the way that we behave. Our mythology about who we are is not necessarily who we are in terms of action. So it's about exploring those seemingly paradoxical things, but trying not to run away from them, trying to incorporate them by understanding them.
Can you give an example of that? Do you remember a time when you thought of something that you decided not to do with her because you went to a truer level?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if I can. Let me think for a second. I guess, you know, there's a couple of places. When she, when there's a scene where they all go to a bar for a dance, and Aries does something that Laurel finds unacceptable in a really, really deep way, and she allows him to go home with her boyfriend rather than to come home with her. And it's, you know, it's quite a rejection of her son. It, you know, even though she's angry at him and he kind of doesn't want to be with her and he says, don't make me come home with you, you know, for a mother to make that choice to say, yeah, get away from me, I don't want to be with you right now, is pretty profound rejection. And she does it, you know, because of the situation and because of all the things that have built up to it. And so, you know, I toyed with what she was going to do in that scene. Was she going to, you know, make him come home, or was she not going to make him come home? Was she going to do this thing of basically saying, I don't want to be with you? Or was she going to overcome her, you know, her emotional moment and say, what my son really needs is for him to be embraced in this moment where he's made a terrible error? And she makes the wrong choice, but it feels right because we know who she is emotionally, and we know, you know, how far she's been driven to the brink of her capabilities. So it was moments like that where you're sort of, you know, faced with two choices, one of which might be more morally correct, but it's not correct in terms of her character.
Hmm. And how do you do your writing? Are you working on a new book right now?
Yeah, I'm working on two books. One is a collection of stories and at the very, very beginning of, you know, thinking stages of a new novel. I do try to work every day. I try to exert some kind of discipline in my life. And I try to give myself a certain amount of words or page count to accomplish every day. And, you know, I just keep chugging like a train. That's my... I don't wait for inspiration to strike. I kind of just plow ahead.
Now, was the, I can't remember now. I know that you've published short stories before. Mm-hmm. Is this your...
This is my second novel.
It was your second novel?
Yeah, before I published a novel called No Direction Home and then a collection of stories called Babe in Paradise.
Could you talk a little bit about the difference between short stories, writing short stories for you and writing a novel?
Well, one thing that isn't different is coming up with a good idea. I mean, you know, it's not any easier to come up with a great idea for a short story than it is for a great idea for a novel for me. I mean, it's, you know, it's not like I can go dash off a short story in my spare time. I think what's different is that a short story demands a kind of compression of action and a compression of character revealing that is really a very different thing from a novel. In a novel, you have much more time to explore, to reveal who a person is, to explore maybe their backstory, or to show many different actions that can all come together to create a character. And in a short story, you have very few brushstrokes with which to work. So it's a little bit like creating a miniature, and it's trying to find those very few actions and very few lines of dialogue and very few moments of behavior that tell an entire story, that open up an entire world. So it's just it's a different kind of challenge.
Fiction writer Marissa Silver. You can read an excerpt from God of War by going to writersvoice.net. Next week, I'll be talking to poet Philip Schultz about his new poetry volume, The God of Loneliness. It'll air the week after that. Here's the poet reciting two poems from that collection. The first is called Failure.
To pay for my father's funeral, I borrowed money from people he already owed money to. One called him a nobody. No, I said, he was a failure. You can't remember a nobody's name. That's why they're called nobodies. Failures are unforgettable. The rabbi who read a stock eulogy about a man who didn't belong to or believe in anything was both a failure and a nobody. He failed to imagine the son and wife of the dead man being shamed by each word. To understand that not believing in or belonging to anything demanded a kind of faith and buoyancy. An uncle counting on his fingers my father's business failures, a parking lot that raised geese, a motel that raffled honeymoons, a bowling alley with roving mariachis, failed to love and honor his brother, who showed him how to whistle under covers, steal apples with his right or left hand. Indeed, my father was comical. His watches pinched. He tripped on his pant cuffs and snored loudly in movies, where his weariness overcame him, finally. He didn't believe in savings, insurance, newspapers, vegetables, good or evil, human frailty, history, or God. Our family avoided us, fearing boils. I left town, but failed to get away. Things I have to do today. Check why my car's engine light keeps blinking. Shift two tutorials so I can attend Eli's play tomorrow. Make sure Prometheus Bound is by Aeschylus so I won't confirm his growing suspicion of my ignorance. He's a teenager. Call Santos to patch and paint the upstairs ceiling link. Get Monica to pick paint color before he gets too busy. Congratulate Joel and Odette on publishing their first stories. Adjust the basketball hoop before the boys grow any taller. Finish reading the Norwegian novel about a man living alone in the woods with his dog, even though the voice is so at peace with the trees and river and light, it frightens me. Replace the outside light so raccoons don't get into our garbage. Clip Penelope's nails and find a way to help my students be less afraid and what in them is most vulnerable, powerful, and unwilling to settle. Find the courage to begin the poem about a man at his window trying to imagine a place where the fragile chemistry of his happiness can survive his envy, ignorance, and guilt. Where the poor aren't tricked into believing poverty is a weakness and shame and inheritance. Where great wealth isn't made at the expense of the weak, the naive, and the frightened. Where his sons won't inherit his anguish and ignominy. Where his love for others is greater than his pity for himself. Where truth isn't despised by the bitter, the angry, and greedy. Where everything he loves isn't lost forever. Where the fire can survive even the anger of the gods unbound.
Philip Schultz reading from his new collection of poetry, The God of Loneliness. Thanks to Tony Ernst of WPKN for the recording. It aired on the WPKN show, East End, Inc., with Hazel Kahn. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.